There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Jordan Jarrett Bryan of Channel 4 News, and David Priest, the columnist and coach. You don't need to be a genius to work out that London might be a little lively on Friday. The Tartan Army are in town, tickets or no tickets for Wembley. For many, the old school rivalry between England and Scotland will be the best bit about the European Championship. Will we have another dentist chair moment? Who knows? It's the sort of match that could defy form and logic. Now, managers talk about playing the game and not the occasion, David. How difficult is that as a player?
I think on some occasions, yeah, it can be very difficult, especially just sort of after the game kicks off and you get caught in the emotion of it all. But certainly in the build-up, I think it's what Gareth Southgate will be doing is he's trying to focus on the processes of what they're trying to do in the game, what's their game plan, and just focus on solely on that. I think even though probably now or in recent years more than ever, there's been a far bigger gap than there used to be between the England and Scotland sides in terms of quality. And I think that what Gareth will be drumming into them as well is a sense of not being complacent. Too many times managers can get a couple, certainly a club level can be caught up in sort of, we've got to match them for effort or we've got to be up for the fight and all this rhetoric. When really it's, Gareth now will just be saying to them that we have to focus on what we're doing, we've had to focus on what our game plan is, and then they shouldn't need to be at this level and this occasion. They shouldn't be needed to have any sort of extra motivation on top of that. And I hope I'm not doing Scotland sort of a disservice by, you know, sort of saying that about the, you know, the England's guarding against complacency, because we know in these games that they can be a bit of a leveler sometimes and you know, Scotland can raise their game. And they certainly have got the threats of their own. But I think anybody, you know, any third party looking from the outside would definitely say that, and I have to admit that England have more quality and are big favourites for the game.
Yeah, you know, there has been a nationwide hype alert, I suppose. Jordan, how relevant is this sort of rivalry? Is it a bit of a throwback to less elitist, you know, more narrow times?
Interesting question. I think in footballing terms, the relevance of this fixture is lesser than it was maybe 15, 20 years ago. I think the relevance of this particular encounter comes from things beyond football. So I think that the kind of the dynamics of the two countries politically and culturally, with the independence that's happened in recent years or the independence referendum, the two countries' approaches to COVID and Brexit, I think those are the things that I think that there's a relevance there on the pitch. I mean, I'm just going to say it. I think England should be winning this game 4-0. And I know that will be highly offensive to many Scottish listeners here. And I'm not trying to be offensive. But I think that the relevance on the pitch, I think Scotland's role of these European Championships has been massively inflated. Whenever I hear a team discussed and you hear the phrases, lots of heart and spirit and fan base so much, I always think to myself, you can't be that good if that is your biggest strength. I'm sorry, but you can't be that good. And my concern for Scotland, as in if I were Scottish, would be that they didn't play that badly against Czech Republic and lost 2-0. But there was a lot of commitment. There was a lot of spirit. What next? What next? Because I know they may be bringing in Tierney, who won't be fully fit for this England game. But my concern would be, you've kind of shown us your hand with what you've got in terms of spirit, guts and work ethic. The quality I don't think is there. So I think in terms of your question, the relevance on the pitch, if I'm Gareth Southgate, similar to David, it's difficult because England are halfway through. They're pretty much through. So do you go down the road of, all right, boys, we don't have to win this game. Don't get caught up in the battle tour. Don't get caught up in the emotion. Control the game. Worst case, a draw isn't the end of the world. Or do you say, we're much better than them. Go and show them we're better than them. Go and take control of the group, win the game, and let's get this group done and dusted. I'm not quite sure what approach he will take, but I think it's definitely an opportunity for the England team to put a marker down for the tournament. If they were to put a 4-5-0 down here, I think Scotland aren't great, granted, but I think that really announces England as like, okay, these guys aren't really here to play games.
Yeah, I suppose what's interesting, we talk about tournament teams, don't we, Dave, but also there are tournament managers. In that context, do you expect Gareth Southgate to take a longer view here and maybe make some changes from the opening game?
Yeah, I do. I think if, you know, rather than making changes in that, I mean, he could still make more changes in the, for the Czech Republic game. But I also think that rather than putting what he deems a stronger side out first game, stronger side out second game, and then sort of make changes for the third, I think he'll probably make changes this game because, he can, because, you know, we know the talk that's been about the likes of Jack Grealish being left out. So it's not a case of weakening your side, really. It's just bringing in different players who give you a different option. Now, I know for a fact that Gareth Southgate will, over his time as England manager, will have studied what it takes to get far in tournaments, what other teams have done, what other approaches other teams have taken in Euros and in World Cups to kind of get through to the last stages relatively unscathed. I think the other day I said about, made the analogy about Tim Henman at Wimbledon, you know, how he go five sets early in the tournament and was shattered by the end of it. He wants to guard against that and try and bring some freshness in early on in the tournament to keep the freshness for the rest of the tournament should they go further. He has to do that, and it'd be wise to do that.
I think it's a good point David makes there, but I disagree. I think that he won't make many changes. I think the only change he may make is Phil Foden. I think he may look at Phil Foden and think he was flagging a little bit in the latter part of that first game. He's young. We've won the first game. There's no pressure. He might bring in a Grealish. I think he'll keep Trippier at left back. I don't think he will want to be seen to be, he seems to be a man that's kind of in his own head, and he's got his own mind about what he wants to do. I think despite the fact that there were some boring parts of that first game, I think Southgate will be quite pleased with that first game and the performance. So I think he'll think, you could argue Croatia are better than Scotland. I know they've got less motivation because of the derby element of it, but they're better than Scotland. So if we beat Croatia with that team, why tinker with it too much unless there's injuries? I don't foresee many changes, if any at all.
I think it's just probably boiled down to, you know, we're talking about Gareth being a tournament manager, and rather than sort of, maybe he's in the past, I think we could be guilty of trying to build a sort of solid side together and keeping the same team together and playing it all the way through the tournament. So like, you build some sort of chemistry and relationship with the players and momentum. But I think now, because the way that he looks at it, he will see it as a different proposition. So while Sterling and Foden were threats in behind and a certain type of threat, maybe this time, you know, Scotland aren't going to give us the space in behind that Croatia would do. And that, like Jack Grealish, is going to be integral into breaking down that Scotland defence because he'd be receiving the ball deeper and has to break the lines with the ball rather than with passes.
Mm. It's interesting you talk there about Kieran Trippier, Jordan, because I've got a hunch he might actually transfer him over to right back. You know, irrespective of what decision he takes on him, it just shows how important a senior pro like that is in the context of a longer tournament. I thought it was really significant that Tyrone Mings spoke after the Croatia game about how Trippier talked him through that first game. So that's the value in that sense. While we stay with the defence, do you think, Jordan, that it is the time to gamble with the fitness of Harry Maguire, or do you wait another game?
I'd wait. As I said, I don't think, and I'm sounding really harsh here, I just don't think Scotland have much up top. I'm not a Tyrone Mings fan. I thought he was brilliant against Croatia. I thought he was really good and was rightfully lauded. I'm not a fan of his, but I think he's good enough and he's earned the right to be able to start again against Scotland. So I personally would wait. I know there's news this morning that Maguire's declaring himself fit. That for me, and David's a player, so he can to say more than me, but whenever a player says that, it makes me think, are you really fit? Or you just, is that your heart telling us that you want to play and you're ready to go? I don't think we have to play Maguire or risk him in this game. I think if we win this game and we're through, then you've got, as they say, a free hit against Czech Republic. Play him in that game. Use that as the kind of ease-in game, if you like, for the rest of the tournament. But no, I wouldn't risk him. I don't think we need to.
Yeah. Element of the smoke screen there, Dave?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, like Jordan was saying about, you know, whether he is fully fit or not. I think you have two types of players. You have one type of player who's so desperate to play, they'll play even when they're just about fit, but not quite fit enough for competitive games at an international level. Or you have the ones that are always unsure and need to be guided by the physio whether they're going to play or not. And in some ways, you know, like, you know, he's an old-fashioned type that's just wants to play no matter what. But England have got to be very clever about this. And I agree with Jordan, you know, why risk him now when you can give him a little bit more time to recover and to strengthen his ankle and give him a game where, yeah, there's not so much of a need for us to win the game.
And if I'm correct in my assertion that I think England win this game 4-0, bring him on 70 minutes. You know, if you get 3-0 up, then bring him on for the last 20 minutes or so. But I just don't, I'm not a Maguire fan, but I just think that he's England's best centre-back. I just don't think you need to risk him in this game. So why chance it?
It's interesting that Marcus Rashford has been taking his role in front of the media this week, obviously talking up the nature of the Scotland game. He's saying it's one of the biggest that we play, one of the games that we remember for the rest of our careers, which might be over-egging and putting a little bit. But I suppose, Jordan, on Marcus Rashford and the broader impact that he's made, it's just about a year now since he made his intervention in the child hunger debate. What has he proved about professional footballers in that time, do you think?
That the old adage of just shut up and bounce the ball, I think it was in the States 30 years ago, is dangerous and actually, you know, harmful. I think that what he's proved is that he's a human being. He's proved that he's a human being and he has the same thoughts and fears and concerns and inspirations and wanting to help as me, you and David. He's proven that he's a human being and he's proven that despite his huge wealth and his significant youth, he's in a position to help others. And you're never going to find a bigger supporter of Marcus Rashford than me. I always say, I think it's really underestimated what this man has done. I think it's really, really underestimated what he's done. He has taken on the government and won. He has done something that certain politicians can't do. He's done something that Boris Johnson's own backbenchers can't get him to do. People on his side. I think he's a phenomenal young man. And I think that shouldn't be missed in the discussion around the influence that footballers can have. And my dream is this. England to get to the final, Marcus Rashford or Raheem Sterling to score the winner in the 90th minute and then take the knee. And I'm going to see all those people that are booing taking the knee. I want to see how they react then. Are they going to continue to cheer because Marcus Rashford has won us the Euros, or are they going to be like, no, boo, boo, boo? That's my dream, but I accept that it's a stretch.
Do you know what I find funny about all this situation as well? It's that it's the very same people then when you have Wayne Rooney or any footballer, but particularly I remember about Wayne Rooney looking down the lens of the camera and swearing down there and people being outraged. Oh, he's a role model. He shouldn't be doing this for kids. Yet when they do something that's used for good, then it's even now, I mean, you say about 30 years ago, even now politicians are saying, oh, I should concentrate on playing football. you know. Mm-hmm. And it's those exact same people who have this exact opposing arguments. It's crazy.
Well, amen to your thought, Jordan. That would be amazing, wouldn't it? I suppose the other thing is, if we talk about leaders, Harry Kane is a different type of leader. But is he almost, does he represent an incipient dilemma, do you think, Jordan? Because, you know, here's someone, only 2 goals in 10 games, the last 10 games for England. There is a sense almost that he's no longer untouchable. Do you expect him to answer any critics that might be around?
You know what? With Harry Kane, and this is coming from an Arsenal fan, I trust Harry Kane. I feel very safe when I watch Harry Kane that he might have a bad game, he might not score a goal, but over the course of a season, over the course of a tournament, his catalogue of work and his ability to lead, as you say, in the way that he leads, he's not a shouter and a screamer and a grab you by the shirt, let's go, lad. He's a leader in the kind of David Beckham sense, I say, which is his actions on the pitch. I trust him that he will do what needs to be done to get England as far as possible. I never think it's healthy for players to feel untouchable. I think there needs to be, even if you're Lionel Messi or Cristiano Ronaldo, and for what it's worth, I think the untouchable nature around Ronaldo, I think, could backfire on Portugal later on, but that's a different discussion. But I think all people need to know that you are not untouchable. You are our best player. You are our captain. But I thought it was really significant that he was substituted in that first game. Now, after the collision with the post, Southgate may say precautions and I want to protect him. I didn't think it was that bad from what I saw. But he subbed his captain and his star player. And I think just that kind of little nudge, if it was from Southgate, that look, you've not played well today, mate. And if you don't play well, you can and will be subbed. I think it's really, really important for a player to know that they are not untouchable.
Yeah, I think it is pretty significant that Gareth Southgate, he isn't afraid to make the difficult, unpopular decision, which I think it does say a lot about the depth of his character. I want to just, if I could, David, talk about the guy that you see alongside him quite regularly on the touchline, his number two, Steve Holland. You know, with your experience of coaching as part of a group, how important is the role of someone like Steve Holland to the bigger picture?
Well, he's massively important. I think what's sometimes, especially in football, we forget is that coaching is teaching, you know, and where a manager possibly has to deal with, you know, something that's more all-encompassing and perhaps more on a personal level with players and with relationships. The guy who, I'm not sure whether he still puts the cones out, Steve Holland, I'm sure he does, but the guy who puts the cones out and puts the sessions and delivers the sessions, he's so vital to what they want to do as a team. You know, it's... You can always say that anybody can put a drill on, anybody can put a session on, but somebody who can deliver it in a way that it's received and people understand it, and it's so vital. And that's probably, you know, it's obviously his huge quality is that, he can teach players, they learn under him. And the fact he's so highly regarded by so many managers who are highly regarded themselves, I think it just shows the stature of the man. And another thing it shows is that, you know, I think it's great that he hasn't been tempted into going as his own man. I think a lot of people, a lot of coaches, and a lot of very good coaches, they get tempted and think, well, I can do that job and do the top job, and then they lose themselves in it, and they lose themselves in, or lose the great coach that they were, because there's so many things come from the outside and that they've got to worry about and think about. And I think that's, you know, it's great credit him. He's seen that, you know, he's a very good coach. This is what I'm brilliant at, and this is my role that I'm going to take forward.
Yeah, it's interesting looking at another Chelsea alumnus, Steve Clark, Scotland manager. He was criticised, wasn't he, Jordan, for actually almost a cautious selection in the opening game. You've talked about Tierney coming back, and it does seem that his fragility is a bit of a worry both for club and country. I suppose, is all we can expect from Steve Clark what he can get, actually extract the best he can from what, as you implied earlier on, is a limited squad?
Yes, Yes, I think that I actually like Steve Clarke, and I've always liked him. I don't quite know why, but I've always liked Steve Clarke. I think he conducts himself really well. I think he's a decent, solid football manager that has, you know, wherever he's been, as far as I'm aware, had decent to good results. I don't feel that Scotland team is anything particularly special in terms of personnel. So I think what you have to do, and I think there's a lot of teams in this Euros in that kind of band of, you know, okay teams with two or three really good players. It's just unfortunate for Scotland that their two or three good players are both left backs, which is really unfortunate for them. But yeah, I think what he needs to do is keep Scotland in games. There's a lot of nations, I would say, you're not going to batter anybody. It's unlikely you're going to cause an upset by being the better team. It's that kind of thing of just stay in the game, and you will get a moment. And I think if he can keep Scotland solid, and for this game on Friday, if they can still be in the game come 70 minutes, you just never know. And I think that what I would advise, if he's listening to this podcast, him to do is to set up a team that's just hard to beat. And they may have to trade off the old, you know, stereotypes of, you know, battle hardened and, you know, war friendly and digging in and all that sort of stuff, you know, give it to England. They may have to mix it up a little bit and throw England off their game that way. But I think that what they don't want to do is get to half time and they're 3-0 down. So I think the best tactic for them is to have a team and a game plan that enables them to be hard to beat, where teamwork is the star player, if you like.
Yeah, well, I'm told he listens to us during his long nights of the
too.
Soul.
Me too.
Wales, David, to quote Mark Hughes, no longer little Wales. That's a pretty fair summary, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look over the last two tournaments, you've got to give them a lot of credit, you know, coming from not qualifying for such a long time. Was it 1950 the last time they qualified for a tournament? And they've just... Maybe not surprised everyone with a result yesterday, of course not, because, you know, of previous Euro experience. But I just like them as a team simply because when we spoke about Scotland as well, and Scotland probably, Robertson and Tierney are probably the superstars, but they're lacking someone of a real elite, you know, like Gareth Bale. And he's obviously the talisman. And what you get in a lot of international sizes, you get players who are the best player at their clubs, and you get them, you know, and once they go to international level, then they have their own egos as well, but also they want, you know, they still feel like they want to be the star man and whatever. Well, Wales haven't got that. You know, a lot of the Wales team aren't the best players at their clubs. You know, a lot of their players are used to taking that sort of, not a backseat role, but like a secondary role where they're more workmanlike. And when you've got likes of Aaron Ramsey and you've got Gareth Bale, and then you've got everything else set up behind them who are working hard to make sure that they've got the best chance to show their qualities on the pitch, you know, it's a great recipe for success. And I thought they were well deserving of the win against Turkey. It was, the two chances that Aaron Ramsey had before he actually scored, you know, come by the same way Gareth Bale sort of playing that deeper role and showing that... He's more than just pace, power and finishing, you know? Yeah, I'm really impressed by them all.
Yeah, I suppose what we're talking about is a manifestation of teen spirit, which was obviously first shown up in 2016. On Gareth Bale, Jordan, you know, as you say, he's obviously the catalyst for this. A very underrated, almost misunderstood character, I always felt. Do we see the real Gareth Bale when he's leading his country? I noticed, you know, he was, when he called them all together after the game yesterday into the huddle and he addressed it, you know, it was the usual effing and jeffing, but there was a real passion in his delivery. And that sort of answers the stereotype of Gareth Bale as being a bit dull.
I think it probably does to some degree. I think that a lot of, It's interesting when people talk about Gareth Bale, and they have done for the last few years, about his affinity to Wales and playing for his country, and whether he's at Madrid or Spurs, Wales is is the place where he feels most at home. And they talk about Paul Pogba as well being a different player for France as opposed to United. There's something I think in that, and I think for Gareth Bale it might be because I know that he said he's going back to play with people that he's been playing with since the under-15s. So they're his friends, they're his mates. So it's enjoyable. And I think England can and are learning, I think, a lesson from that as well. I don't think he's the most charismatic and interesting person, but at the same time, I don't think he's dull. I don't think he's dull. I do think he gets a little bit of a harsh rep. I think he's a phenomenal player. And I've got a sneaky feeling he might retire this summer. I've just got this gut feeling that he might tap out after this year. Just a feeling of mine in my gut. But yeah, I do feel he gets a little bit of a harsh ride at certain times. I think that the element of him not leaving Madrid and cancelling his contract, you know, there were calls of him being a mercenary. And if he's not playing, why would you stay? Well, I was with him on that one. I believe that if you're an employee at a company, why should you cancel your contract? Yes, I love playing football. But no, I've worked hard to get to this level and be paid this wage. Why should I just walk away from that? I do feel he gets a little bit of a harsh rep at times. And I think we're seeing his character and his spirit in a Welsh shirt more than any other shirt, to be honest.
Yeah, the thing that strikes me about Wales is that almost necessity has been the mother of invention in terms of, because they've got a lower number of players from which to choose, players tend to be picked earlier. So Gareth Bale made his full debut at 16, Aaron Ramsey 17, Ethan Ampadu at 17, Dan James at 19. Having said all that, David, I want to return to the point that you made about almost unsung heroes within that team. I'd like your assessment, please, of Danny Ward. Now, here's someone who was a second choice goalkeeper at Leicester. He's been a star, hasn't he?
Yeah, and it always amazes me with goalkeepers, you know, that come in from the sidelines, they're not playing at club level, and yet they perform brilliantly for their countries, because it's such a hard thing to do when you're out of, you know, you haven't got that game practice, you're not used to playing games. You can do as much training as you want, but when it comes into game situations, it's hard to replicate, you know, exactly what happens in the game. In training sessions, because of sometimes the lack of intensity, and because of even just by the crowd being there, and it can be affected, but he hasn't looked affected at all. I thought he was great last night. He was solid, made a great save late on, and I think it's credit to him and the backroom staff. And I know there's maybe not too much we can say around this, but the fact that, you know, they've lost their manager, you know, and we know what's happened to Ryan Giggs now, and they've managed to keep everything together and not let that affect them as a squad as well. I think it's great credit to Rob Page and to all the backroom staff as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Jordan, you mentioned Paul Pogba in passing there. I suppose if we're looking to make a review of the first week, you can't look beyond France in terms of the teams which have been really impressed. I suppose what really brought it home to me about what almost a complete team they are was just their willingness to graft. You know, someone like Griezmann absolutely put the proverbial shift in. That tells me that this is a team not just of all talents, but the temperament's right as well.
Yeah, and that's a concern for a lot of the bets that I've got out, because I've tipped Italy from the get-go to win this Euros, and I've got some big bets of a lot of people out, and I was expecting the talent and the skill and the tactical nous, if you like, from Deschamps to come from France. What I wasn't expecting is, as you say, is that Griezmann was pretty much at fullback for most of that game, just tracking and supporting and doubling up. That's something that I didn't foresee. And I think that was something that I remember with the great Barcelona team of 10 years ago, that the most impressive thing for me wasn't Barcelona when they had the ball, it's when they didn't have the ball. That for me was the most kind of noticeable thing. When they didn't have the ball, I think Pep Guardiola had the 8-second rule. You have to get the ball back within 8 seconds. And France are the same, is when they don't have the ball, then they're not as pressing as that Barca team were, but there's definitely a work rate and a work ethic to get back into shape, to double up, to support, to the point where I think it might have almost taken something away from their attacking, you know, game plan as well. But, you know, the first game of the tournament against a team like Germany, I guess it's just get the 3 points on the board and one big team ticked off. So, yeah, I think the bigger worry for everyone else in the competition should be not the skill level that they have. It's the kind of team and work ethic that they displayed in that Germany game that I think will be the bigger concern for teams that thought they might have a chance of winning this competition.
Yeah, we can look at, you know, the pace of Mbappe, which is, you know, self-evident and pretty ridiculous. You can look at, I think, Varane, who's emerging as a world-class defender. If we have to look for any weakness, Dave, and I realise I'm probably being hideously unfair here, do you think it's Lloris in goal?
Yes.
No, I don't actually, you know. I mean, I've probably said before in here that I'm a huge fan of his, like, you know, and I think there's been a lot of high-profile mistakes from him over the last few years in a France shirt, most notably in the World Cup final. But also, he's still a high-quality goalkeeper that, you know, especially shot-stopping, from a shot-stopping point of view, he's every season in the Premier League, he's always in the top three. So I think if you do say that's the one weakness that they've got, it just shows you how strong they are on the rest of the pitch.
Can I just kind of add to that? I said yes because I've never been convinced about Hugo Lloris. I think David says that he's probably in the top three for shots saved, and David's my go-to person when it comes to anything goalkeeping, so I defer to him 100% on this, and I could be talking absolute crap. But he may be in the top three for shots saved the last handful of years in the Premier League. I reckon he'll probably be in the top three, top five for most gaffes every year as well in the Premier League. I don't, and that's the reason for me why, and I know David gets really upset when people kind of talk about gaffes because, you know, I've not been in goals. I don't know what it's like. And what I say is a gaffe, maybe David would say is a fair goal to be scored. But the reason why I've never been convinced by Hugo Lloris is because he'll, in the same game, he'll make the save of the season, and then he'll do something absolutely insanely, embarrassingly bad. And for me, the best goalkeepers, and again, I defer to David on this one, for me, the best goalkeepers are the ones, especially now in this age, are the ones that make minimal mistakes. Every goalkeeper will make a gaffe at some point in the season. Even the keepers that win the leagues probably will. They'll make one. But I don't judge keepers on how many saves they make. I judge keepers now, the elite keepers, on how many mistakes they make. And he makes a gaffe a month. And that, for me, discounts you from being an elite goalkeeper. David, give it to me.
Well, just before he does, you know, there's a phrase I bet that you're familiar with, David, which is he's got a rick in him. And I do get what Jordan is talking about, be honest.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's no denying about the mistakes he's made as well. But I mean, I think if you look at the players he's played with and the respect that you have for him, I think that says a lot more than what, you know, what any of us as outside sort of viewers can, you know, can deliver a verdict on him, because they trust him. And when he does make mistakes, that, you know, it's more than just being about a well-liked character in the dressing room. He's trusted on the field as well, and I think that a lot of the times when you're making saves and you're either keeping the team in a game or saving them points, or actually if you're 1-0 up and you're winning the games with your saves, then you build up a lot of credit in the bank with the players that you're playing with as well. So I think from that perspective, I think he's there wouldn't be many players who's played with him who would say that they didn't trust him as a goalkeeper.
Mm. Let's switch to managers for a second, if we could, Jordan. Managers under pressure. Senol Güneş of Turkey. Now, he took Turkey to third in the 2002 World Cup, but he's a veteran of club football in Turkey, and he knows it is an absolutely unforgiving environment. After two defeats, he's toast, isn't he?
I think he's done. And I think what's not helped him as well, and how much the Turkish Federation, or indeed himself, have paid attention to this, is there was a widespread thought that Turkey were the dark horses in this competition. And I think that when you're talked up as the dark horses and you haven't even scored a goal yet, I believe they've not scored a goal yet, Yeah, that doesn't look particularly good. I don't think they've been bad in the two games that I've seen. I just feel they've been a bit blunt. I know that their forward, forgive me, I forgot his name.
Yilmaz.
He's about 78 years old. Yeah. And at times he looks it. Yeah, I think he's in trouble. I think that, forgive me if I'm wrong here, but if they win their final game, they could still qualify as the third best. But even with 3 points, you're kind of clutching a little bit there. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he's dismissed come the end of the Euros.
Mm. What about Luis Enrique at Spain, David? There's a number of things about him being questioned. His selection, his personality, his in-game management. Again, a little bit like Turkey, Spain and their media know how to stick the knife between the shoulder blades, don't they?
Yeah, they certainly do. And I think that obviously everyone in Spain being expectant to turn Sweden over. But at the same time, you look at the performance, you know, they created more than enough chances to win the game. Having said that, you know, Sweden had chances of their own. I think the way that the game worked out, you know, was it you know, possession in the 70s, percentage of it was in the 70s. Sweden will be happy with that. They're a great out-possession side. They're disciplined, 4-4-2 all the time. They know the jobs inside out, and they have a little bit of quality to create problems. But again, like I said, it's, you know, a manager can only do so much. And I think, you know, regardless of the personnel that was played, they're not the side of 10 years ago, you know. They don't have the personnel of 10 years ago, but they certainly have the personnel to beat Sweden. But you've got to give credit to Sweden as well. But the way that they played, I quite like the way that they played, the intensity that they played with. And again, the chances they created were good enough to win the games. But, you know, you look at Morata, again, same old problem with him, you know, that he misses gilt-edged chances. And, you know, as a manager, there's only so much you can do. You can't put the ball in the back of the net for the players, you know.
Spain's an interesting one because I remember listening to the radio a few days ago ahead of their first game, and they had a very well-known Spanish journalist talking to the presenter, and the presenter asked him, you know, we've discussed Italy and France and Portugal, no one's talking about Spain. And the journalist said, I've spoken in the last kind of 24 hours to the manager Luis Enrique about this, and he said, oh yeah, that's how we like it, that's fine. And the journalist also said that, you know, he found it weird that no one's speaking about Spain. And my thought was, it's not weird. If you look for that Spanish squad, it's not very good. There's not many good players in that Spanish squad. There's some good players in that squad, but I don't think it's weird at all that we're not talking about Spain. And as David says, if your main man up top is Morata, you're in big trouble. So I think Luis Enrique is working with a generation of players that aren't awful. But when I was looking for their squad the other day, I was thinking I could pick out maybe four really top players. And one of them was Thiago Alcantara, who doesn't even start for them. So I find it weird that there's this notion that we should be speaking about Spain when actually the reality is it's not a great squad.
Yeah, I have to say, I love Pedri, you know, only 18, and I mentioned it on the pod last week, you know, and there is a touch of Iniesta about him, I feel. Let's switch it to Germany, David, if we could, and Jogi Löw. The group do seem united. You know, there's always politics usually around the German football camp. They didn't seem really to have much penetration against the French. Do you think we really expected them maybe to make a bit better use of the ball and find a bit more space? Or am I, again, being too harsh?
I think this is probably not the game to judge them on. Like I said, they're playing against France. France, I think it was the two goals they had chalked off because due to VAR as well. So, you know, France were probably as well-deserved winners. It was, I mean, for me, it was closer than I thought it was going to be. They kept in the game. And sometimes you know, we look at Spain there about their lineup, and you think, well, it's not actually, you know, compared to the other teams in the tournament, other elite teams, that it's not actually, you know, up with them. But with Germany, they still have a little bit of that. They still have some big names in there. They still have players who are performing at the highest level, real highest level. And I think that with France the other night, it just kept, it's almost like somebody trying to keep up with, like, you know, somebody who's not, who was quicker than them. You know, they were never quite up with him all the time, you know, and they just sort of falling behind, and they're trying to keep up rather than being with those top teams, just trying to keep up them a little bit. And I think, they still have threats, you know, they still had, you know, who they bring off the bench. It was Sarnia, Timo Werner, threats coming off the bench. So they still have a really good squad, but like I said, I don't think this is the game to judge them on, really.
I think Germany's problem is going to be the fact that you're blunt up front to some degree anyway, and Sané and Timo Werner have not had great seasons this season. So if they're the guys you're bringing on to try... And I'm my favourite player in Europe is Leroy Sané. I love him. Mm-hmm. I actually love him. I'm just obsessed with the guy. I think he's mad talented. But the reality is that he's not playing well. I think Germany, unlike Spain though, do have really good players across that squad. If they get out of this group, I think they're the team that are going to be the most angry because they've been written off. And if we know one thing about Germany, you'd never ever write off Germany. They've been rubbish since 2018 World Cup, granted. But if they can somehow get out of that group, I think they may garner a spirit that makes them think, all right, you know what? Now we're out of the group. We've got past France and Portugal and that out of the way. Let's go, sort of thing. But I think what may end up hurting them is that bluntness up front.
Yeah, I realise I'm probably offering a bit of a hostage to fortune here, but I looked at Leroy Sané and I wondered whether he will actually end up being one of those players who have never quite fulfilled themselves. You're right, Jordan, that he is mad talented, but I just wonder whether or not we will actually see the full blossoming of that talent. Jordan, but what I also want to do, I want to give you the opportunity to speak with your wallet here.
It won't be very long. Much.
Right, you know, you've obviously lumped into Italy. Two players who really stood out for me, at least, both from Sassuolo, Domenico Berardi and Manuel Locatelli. Mm-hmm. They have been, I think, two of the stars of the tournament for me.
I totally agree. And they're players that I'd seen a little bit. I'm not going to lie and say that I've been watching them for 2 years. I've seen a little bit of them pre-tournament. And a couple of Italian friends of mine said to me, look out for these two. They could come out of this tournament as stars. But I think the one thing I've loved about Italy the most is that that for the first time in a long time, it seems like an Italian team that's coordinated. They know what they're doing. They want to play out from the back. They're very comfortable doing that. And the amount of traps they set for Switzerland in playing out for the back to enable them to have so many chances in the final third, I thought was so intelligent. I think Mancini is an underrated manager. I don't know if he's quite in the Klopp, Pep elite bracket of managers yet, but I think he's not in the second tier below. And I'm really backing them. The only thing that concerns me about the Italian team's chances, and they're my tip to win it, is seeing France play in third gear. I think Italy are playing at their best and they're playing very, very well. France got the job done without even playing that well. And that would be, for me, if I was an Italian, the one concern is like we matched. I think you could put their performances on a par, but I think Italy are playing at the best. But yeah, to your question, those two players I think are gonna garner huge interest across Europe amongst some of the best teams across the continent.
Yeah, I suspect the same thing will happen to Alexander Isak. Now, you obviously know Swedish football really well, having worked there, David. What do you think the mood is in Sweden? You know, it seems that Isak actually probably more than compensates for the loss of a declining Ibrahimovic. Again, is he playing himself into a transfer from Real Sociedad at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, definitely going on his performance the other night, you know, he created two great opportunities for himself. And like I said, Swedish teams are 4-4-2, very workmanlike. They all know their jobs. And Isak in this team, he's the little bit of sugar. You know, I think it's quite a good thing that Ibrahimovic isn't there because it would take away from him. Now, sometimes he's been used as a bit of a target man when that's not really his role. He's more than just a target man. You know, he's got great pace, great skill. And I think that the fact that he doesn't have to live under the shadow of Ibrahimovic in this tournament, you know, I mean, he's flourished more, you know. And again, similar to the Wales team, I mean, the Swedish team have, you know, players playing all across Europe. You know, they have Russia's a great place for for Swedish players to go. They tend to take a lot of Swedish players there in Serie A, all over Europe, and big clubs. So, you know, they do have the quality, but also that, like I said, the 4-4-2, they know what they're doing, and Isak can be that little bit of a difference if they're going, or he has to be that little bit of difference if they're going to win games.
Mm. We're going to have to mention Ronaldo, Jordan. You know, a specialist in seizing the occasion. 106 international goals now, three short of Ali Daei's record, which, let's face it, he's going to break it in this tournament, isn't he? It's difficult because Ronaldo attracts extremes, both of praise and criticism. Can you give me a middle ground? Give me your assessment. Can he win this tournament for Portugal?
So I made a very bold claim pre-tournament that I thought Portugal were going to bomb. And I know they're some people's favourites, and they have the second best squad in the tournament. My rationale for making that prediction was that I thought that in the way that Ronaldo was the reason they won the Euros 5 years ago, I think he was a single reason they won the Euros 5 years ago. I know he came off in the final, I think it was, but I think he was the reason they won it. I thought that this time he would be the reason they don't win it, because in previous years it's been Ronaldo and the rest. They've not had the team to really complement one of the greatest players of all time. Whereas now they actually do have some really, really good players. And my concern was that they would still try and funnel everything through Ronaldo. And previously I get why they did that. Whereas now they don't need to do that because you have other good players. But one thing I saw which made me look stupid in the first game was that actually they did the opposite of what I thought they were going to do. So what I was seeing was times where they should have passed to Ronaldo where they didn't. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So I think actually they've got, I might have to row back on that really outlandish claim pre-tournament. And I think he can win them the tournament if he understands his role. And his role for me now is pure goal scorer. Don't ask for the ball wide. Don't try and beat two or three players. Just stay in the box and be that presence, because Ronaldo in the box alone is going to occupy defenders, even without the ball. So I think if he understands that for us to win this tournament, I've just got to be a Harry Kane or a Lewandowski. I've just got to be a guy in the box that's going to finish. Don't need to get involved in build-up play. Then yes, I think Portugal can lead Portugal to retaining their title.
Yeah, I notice you nodding quite vigorously there, David.
Yeah, simply because, you know, like Jordan said, you know, it's been all about him, and if they were going to win anything, it had to go through him, when now it doesn't. And it like Jordan said again, it could go the other way, because the players are so confident in themselves and know that they have that kind of quality. You know, the time that Jota takes the shot when he could possibly slip Ronaldo in, it wasn't the right decision. But at the same time, you know, I think that's what he's become. You know, over these past 6-7 years, he just realised he's about the numbers, and he realises that he can trust the other 10 players. He can leave it up to them and just make sure that he's in the right areas at the right time. And they have great quality all the way through the side. I mean, the only worry I have about the likes of Portugal and Italy, I mean, I've been so impressed with Italy. They're just so un-Italian at the moment, incisive, direct, playing with real energy and pace. My only worry is, and it'd be the same if England were in that position, was that they're peaking too early. You know, like we've talked about tournament football before, and it's very rarely that a team sets off on, you know, on fire in the first couple of games and continues that all the way through the tournament.
Just back on Ronaldo, I think the documentary that's come out in the last few weeks on the BBC, I watched it. And I just think, for all the criticisms that I think you can level at Ronaldo, one of the things that I'm in awe of with when it comes to him, it's just the insatiable need to want to be better. He just seems to be relentless in, I'm going to break all the record. New record, I'm going to break it. New record, I'm going to break it. And I think that is something that I think I personally have a lot of respect for and drives me on. It's just this selfless need to just want to be the greatest of all time in every single area. I respect it. I really respect it.
Yeah, you talk to people around the Real Madrid teams that he played in. That comes across really strongly. He's the guy on the plane back from a Champions League tie saying to his teammates, come back to my place. He's got a private gym, cryogenic chamber. he looks after himself. You know, someone told me that they were in the dressing room after winning the Champions League, came in off the pitch. Obviously, it was carnage within the dressing room, people taking photos with a trophy. And you had Ronaldo and Sergio Ramos walking around that dressing room saying, we're going to win it again next year. And that is minutes after they received it this year. That tells me everything I need to know about Ronaldo, I think. On the broader sense, David, I just want to look at the nature of the tournament and what that says about modern football. Do you think there's any real sense of jeopardy about this stage of the tournament when, let's face it, so many teams that finish third in their groups are going to get through?
Yeah, there is that, but I also think for us as viewers and following the tournament, I think the more knockout stages they are, the better. That's where the real entertainment comes. That's where the real drama comes. So, you know, if it means that less teams are out in the group stages and more go through to a knockout stage, that's exactly what we want. You know what I mean? It's everyone wins in that circumstance, you know. But it's perhaps, time will tell whether it does take away from this, you know, the next few games. Of course, the first game of every tournament in all the groups from all the teams, there's always the excitement and the intensity's there. And once things settle down a bit, we might get a few drab games. But, once that's over, I think, you know, that's where the tournament starts.
Mm. Is that, Jordan, almost, you know, symptomatic of a wider issue about, you know, football in danger of losing its edge simply because of almost financial and political expedience? You know, you only got to look at this bloated Champions League that we've got to look forward to in 2024.
Yeah, I do. And I think I said on the last time I was on your podcast, Mike, that I'm just being honest, that the amount of games that we now have through the calendar, and I understand because of the pandemic, there's had to be a truncated season where there's more games in a very shorter period of time. But it's to some degree put me off. I've not watched every Premier League game or even wanted to watch every Premier League game this season, because I think when you have football every single day and you have, you know, during the Euros it's a bit different because it's a one-off, one-month tournament. But I think that there is a danger that the expansion of these competitions is going to we're going to drown and get football sick to some degree. I don't care how passionate a football fan you are. There's only so much we can take. And people talk about the group of death, the Germany, Portugal, France group. Well, it's not a group of death because those three teams will qualify. You know what I mean? There's no jeopardy there. There's a very, very slim chance that Germany, France and Portugal won't get through. So that element of needing to win a game to qualify, I think means something. And taking that away, I think impacts on the quality of football and the excitement levels as fans that we have for watching the sport that we love.
Yeah, I think one thing the tournament has given us was an absolutely enduring image of the need for player welfare. You know, the sight of Christian Eriksen's cardiac arrest and mercifully his subsequent recovery, that had a special significance to you, didn't it, David?
Yeah, when I was in there, when I was playing in Denmark and with Odense, Christian was at the club. He was a 16-year-old at Odense. And it's funny because he probably trained with us with the first team at least once a week, sometimes twice. And even though he was such a talent at that age, I mean, he was a ridiculous talent. Even when he trained with the first team, you know, I'll put this politely, he took the mickey out of players. He was playing, you know, he'd be playing against, he's a slight guy anyway, you know, he's not the biggest physically. Imagine him at 16 when he's 5'5" and, you know, he wasn't impressive physically, where, you know, a lot of players like to win Rooney, they're in that position because they're physically, they're a man. He wasn't, he was still a boy. But he was up against, say, the likes of internationals, you know, like Eric Jemba, who I know he gets a lot of stick from his time in England, but somebody who was a Cameroonian international, a very good player, strong, and he would make him look like a fool some days. Yeah, so, you know, from that year I spent at Odense, you know, spent a lot of time with him, and he was always going to be a special talent. He was never involved in the second team. They wouldn't involve him in the first team simply because they knew he was just getting ready to leave to a big club. I think he had a chance to go to Real Madrid, Barcelona, Chelsea, and Ajax. And he took the Ajax route before his development because he knew that, you know, instead of taking the big leap from Odense to one of these big clubs, maybe like an Ødegaard did, that he would take the one in between. And it served him well. So, you know, watching those scenes, it was, you know, I wasn't actually watching the game because I was at a relative's house and I just saw something on Twitter and put the TV on straight away. Yeah, it was a terrible thing to see, you know, and to see his wife in, you know, in such a state at the side of the pitch, which obviously naturally she would be. And it really strikes you. I mean, even if you didn't have to know him to hit you really hard, you know, it's just something that's... Something can happen in football and different factions of football can, you know, can be affected by it, where this is just something that affects everybody. And like you said, thank God that he's pulled through. And in many ways, you know, of course you don't want to see that happen to anybody, but in many ways, you know, it's the way that his teammates reacted to him and the outpouring of emotion towards him and afterwards, it's great when something like that, you see something like that happen and all of football comes together and all the world comes together.
Yeah, well said. I just want to end actually, Jordan, if I could, with a related issue in many ways. The example of Benjamin Pavard against Germany, he took two hits to the head, was allowed to continue. Why isn't it that football, after all the evidence... and all the promise of protocols that they'll follow evidence, that followed that evidence of links to dementia, why on earth aren't we still having temporary concussion substitutes to work it all out?
I don't know, Mike, is my honest answer. I'm not sure. I mean, the my instinctive answer is always to kind of, my default is to go, where's the money? And is there a financial benefit to somebody or an organization to not, you know, apply this? And I don't want to believe that, but I genuinely don't understand it. But what I will say is that if we don't start respecting the health and safety of players, something really sad, and we almost, I mean, I know there was a bit of a, if you like, freak, there was no one was to blame as to what happened with Ericsson, but I think we're going to have an example of where poor practice of protocols is going to really leave us with a tragedy. And I think that unless we relook at this, and I think it goes to even, you mentioned earlier on, the amount of games that footballers are playing now. Again, David, you're a former player. We mentioned before we started recording the fixtures coming out. Just this incessant games and plays they must be knackered. They must be not only physically but mentally as well. It's been mentally strong, difficult. Sorry for everybody. So sorry, David. Go on.
No, I was just going to say. I think it's something that football and especially footballers at the high level have been caught up in now. That it's kind of like because of the money that they're earning, and then obviously at the elite level that they're demanding that they earn now. Then it's kind of like it's
maximize it while you can.
Well, there is that, but also they're caught up in the game now. They're caught. It's kind of a deal with the devil where they, you know, they have this much money. They earn this much money. Why are they earning this much money? Because of all the money that comes in from TV deals. So they really feel obliged that they have to play all these games. There's never going to be any kickback because now that's the deal they've made. You're earning millions of pounds a year. This is what you've got to do for it now. And of course, the past year and a half, it's something that we've never experienced before with a pandemic, and it's something that we probably never have to deal with again. And it's, you know, these circumstances aren't normal, but it's certainly, like I said, it's a deal with the devil that we've made.
Yeah, well, it really does seem endless at the moment. You know, the final of the Euros is on July the 11th. The qualifying rounds of the Champions League begin 9 days later. Now, that involves some pretty substantial ties. Celtic against Midtjylland, PSV against Galatasaray. Now, surely we're reaching a point where players are going to say, enough is enough. I get what you mean, David, that they're following the money and they have made that deal with the devil. The careers might be lucrative, but they will inevitably be shortened. I think they deserve greater protection, especially when the potential damage of things like concussion has been proven. It's a big subject. In the meantime, I just want to give thanks to Jordan and David for their insight, and to you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.